Up next, Vincent Palomera joins us, our third special guest in our JFK report. He's a noted author. We'll get into some of his works and question him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back. Let me tell you about our third special guest, Vince Palomera is a leading civilian literary Secret Service expert. He is the author of a number of books, including The Not-So-Secret Service, Survivor's Guilt, JFK from Parkland to Bethesda. He has appeared in more than 100 other authors' books, radio, television, DVDs, newspapers. He's been at national conferences and many online resources as well. Vincent, welcome to the program. Looking forward to chatting with you.
Oh, George, same here. And thank you to all your listeners. Appreciate it.
Vince, you've been doing this for some time. Your website is your name, vincepalomera.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. What got you involved in this?
You could basically thank my parents. They're still doing great. Yeah, they were and still are big Kennedy fans. Their interest rubbed off on me as a youngster.
Yeah.
And make a long story very short, it all really came together in 1978 when I was the tender age of 12. Two things happened that had a profound interest on my life at the time. The House Select Committee was the second major government investigation of the assassination, where they came to the conclusion that there was a probable conspiracy in the death of President Kennedy. At the same time, might seem incongruous, but there was a television show called The Wild Wild West, which was an exciting fictional take on the 19th century Secret Service. So you might say the two blended together, so to speak. I became fascinated with both Kennedy's life and death and the men sworn to protect him. I find myself looking at books and films and looking behind and beside Kennedy at the usually unnamed Secret Service agents. Then you jump up to 1988, which is the 25th anniversary, my interest really took off. And then my coming out party was 1991, a major presentation I gave at the Kennedy Conference in Fredonia, New York, in front of authors and researchers who, age-wise, could have been either my father or my grandfather. And their tremendous response to my largely, at that time, secondary source overview of the Secret Service inspired me to do actual primary research and to seek out as many surviving Secret Service agents that protected President Kennedy as I could. And since that time, that's what I've done.
Mm-hmm. And obviously something went awry that day in Dallas. Do you think the Secret Service dropped the ball?
Yes, that's my big conclusion. That's the big overview. I mean, I'm a big admirer of the Secret Service, and they've been around since, you know, basically 1865 to the present time. So, and they've done a lot of good. There's a lot of honorable men and women, but it's not Monday morning quarterbacking to say, quite frankly, whether you believe there's a conspiracy or no conspiracy, whether you think it's, you know, the mob, the CIA, whoever was behind, you know, the assassination. The bottom line is the Secret Service let it happen. They left Kennedy a sitting duck in Dallas, and we can get into the nuts and bolts beyond that. But, yeah, that's basically the situation. Yeah,
Vincent, let's talk about what you believe are three main reasons that there was a conspiracy in the death of the president. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, based on intense research and primary interviews of doctors and medical personnel that make up the bulk of my second book on the medical evidence in the JFK assassination, which is titled JFK from Parkland to Bethesda, there's an overwhelming consensus that the president was shot at least twice from the front, in addition to at least once, if not twice, in the rear. Entrance wounds make small holes. Exit holes make large wounds. The vast majority of both the Parkland personnel in Dallas and the Bethesda personnel at the autopsy demonstrate that JFK had an exit wound in the right rear of his head, the occipital parietal area in medical terms. The president also had an entrance wound in the front of his neck and the back wound, not a back of the neck wound, but an actual back wound down in the shoulder area, did not penetrate the chest, nor did it connect with the neck wound. And a lot of these medical witnesses on both hospitals, both sides of the coin, do not believe the single bullet theory is absolutely essential in having Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone shooter. So this is based on primary research and talking to a lot of, you know, surviving doctors and whatnot of both hospitals and corresponding with them. The second major reason would be based on two recent books. People wonder, like, oh, this is an old case. I'd say the literary, like, works of the last 5 to 10 years have been some of the best ever. Two recent books, one by Barry Ernest, The Girl on the Stairs, and the other one by Flip DeMay, The Lee Harvey Oswald Files, conclusively proves in my mind that Lee Harvey Oswald was not on the sixth floor during the assassination. Now, here's the side of it, though. His rifle may indeed have been used, but he himself did not fire it. Okay.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So these books together are essential in debunking the Warren Commission, Gerald Posner, Vince Bugliosi tales that Oswald acted alone, there was no conspiracy.
Wasn't he like spotted on the lunch floor or something like that?
Yes, he was spotted on the second floor by Dallas police officer Marion Baker and Roy Truly. He was the Texas School Book Depository manager. And other people soon after saw him sauntering through and, you know, wasn't in any hurry to get out of there. But, yeah, it was like less than 90 seconds later. But the bottom line is two women on the, you know, who were coming down from the fourth floor did not see or hear him. And they were real creaky old stairs, wooden stairs. They didn't see or hear anybody come down the stairs. And Oswald, the official story, said he hadn't been coming down. So there you go. And, you know, you talk about three reasons. But the third major reason would be, based on interviews and correspondence with the former Secret Service agents signed to President Kennedy, there's a dozen of them that believe there was a conspiracy. Sam Kinney, the driver of the Fall car in Dallas, told me he believed that there was definitely a conspiracy. Abraham Bolden, the first African-American agent assigned to the White House detail. John Marshall, the special agent in charge of the Miami field office. Maurice Martineau, the special agent in charge of the Chicago office. Robert Bauch, who was a special agent in charge of the intelligence section of the Secret Service. Bill Greer and Roy Kellerman, who were in the limousine, gave testimony to the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee that could definitely be extrapolated. They believe that there was more than one shooter. Gerald O'Rourke was another Texas Trip agent who came out in the 40th anniversary of the assassination in 2003 to advocate that there was a conspiracy behind the death of JFK. Interest of time, I'll just name the other ones. John Norris, Forrest Sorrells, Paul Landis, mm-hmm. and Lem Johns. Pretty fascinating. Not just conspiracy theorists or authors, people that were actually there.
The late William Cooper theorized that the Secret Service driver of the limousine turned and fired at the president. Now, I've looked at this video over and over again, Vincent. I can't see that at all. What do you think?
Yeah, that's total bunk. Yeah, I don't believe that either. There's no way, shape, or form in clear, normal copies of the Bruder film. No, it's not a gun. It's actually Roy Kellerman's forehead in the sunlight, and people in bad copies extrapolate that to be a small pistol. But the ironic thing is, while Bill Greer did not shoot the president, he allowed the triggers to do their dirty work. Even people like Gerald Posner, Vince Boulieris, who credit Greer for the success of the assassination. In fact, Greer, he holds the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, because when the first shot of shots rings out, he looks back and stares at the president, okay, against his training and common sense. Roy Kellerman sitting feet away from him. His boss says, get out of line, we've been hit. Bill Greer disobeys a direct order on common sense and training and turns around a second time and staring at Kennedy until the fatal shot makes its mark. Only then does he face forward to the Warren Commission. He denied that he ever saw Kennedy and just denied the whole thing, that he hit the gas and, you know, did what he could. Although that day he had a lot of remorse. When he got to the Parkland Hospital, he told Jacqueline Kennedy, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, if only I would have swerved the car.
Mm-hmm.
And all this. And then, but he changed his tune from that night on at the morgue talking to the FBI agents because he kind of realized the ramifications of what went down. And interesting postscript, Bill Greer died in 1985. I spoke to his son Richard in 1991. I asked Richard, well, what did your father think of President Kennedy? And there was a dead silence on the phone. I'm like, okay. So I went to some other innocuous questions.
Yeah.
Came back to him and said, sir, what did your father think of President Kennedy? And he said, well, we're Methodists, and JFK was Catholic. And it turns out, there's another postscript, Bill Greer was born and raised in County Tyrone, Ireland, only emigrating to this country at the age of 18. So as we know, for generations, Protestants and Catholics don't exactly like each other over there. So it's grist from the mill. That's funny. To a total stranger on the phone, he didn't just say, like, oh, he loved President Kennedy, and President Kennedy loved him. He said, well, we're Methodists, and JFK was Catholic.
Interesting take. Now, the Secret Service foiled two apparent assassination attempts prior to Dallas, Tampa and Chicago.
Right.
This one got through. What happened? Yeah. What went wrong?
What went wrong, quite frankly, is very little that went right. You know, people sometimes have a tendency to look through 21st century eyes and say, oh, come on, Vince, you're being a little too tough. Monday morning quarterback, and come on, the Secret, you know, they was a sitting duck no matter where he went back in. But there's a reason why presidents survived. And just in the interest of time, I can just rattle them off. What went down, what went wrong was, and this is a major discovery of mine, and it's just through, you know, research, a little amateur me out there in the wilderness, It turned out that since the FDR days, multi-story building rooftops were guarded during presidential parades, not just in Washington, D.C., but around the world. And there's much documentation on it. Now, these are old newspaper archives I dredged, you know, from the FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy days, you know, and just talking about Kennedy only for a second. When he went to Nashville, when he went to Chicago, when he went to Paris, when he went to Germany, 4 days before in Tampa, 28-mile motorcade, the longest domestic motorcade Kennedy ever undertook, far longer than Dallas. Every multi-story building was guarded with the sheriff's department, heavily armed guards. And I spoke to Russell Groover, one of the Tampa motorcycle police. He says, "Oh yeah, Vince, every floor on some of the buildings were even guarded, let alone all the rooftops." And so that's how they got around the manpower issues. And people look at a still photo sometimes and say, "Hey, Kennedy looks like a sitting duck." They don't realize, well, the car is in motion, the buildings are being protected, and the $64 million question is, well, why didn't they do that in Dallas? Especially a city he was warned against. None of that happened there. Another major, probably one of the biggest things people know me about is they say, "Hey, Vince, I understand, you know, that myth about, you know, President Kennedy supposedly didn't want the agents on the car." You know, the big myth is, again, 4 days before Dallas, he supposedly turned to Floyd Boring, the assistant special agent in charge, and said, "Get those Ivy League Charlton's off the back of my car."
Huh.
Well, I spoke to Floyd Boring on two occasions and corresponded with him. He told me that's not true, not true at all. President Kennedy was a very nice man, never interfered with our actions at all. I spoke to his boss, the number one agent, Gerald Bain, in 1992, and he said, "I don't remember Kennedy ever saying anything about not having agents on the back of the car. If you look at the newsreels, you'll see agents on there." And he quoted the trip to Berlin he was on. And so it's like, whoa, again, the $64 million question. Wait, one after another, all these agents, former agents, were talking to a total stranger on the phone, me, all across the country, and they're all telling me the same thing. "Oh, President Kennedy never interfered with actions, didn't order anybody off the car. That's baloney." In fact, that's what R. Godfrey said. That's total baloney. But yet, you read the Warren Commission report in William Manchester, they throw the onus on Kennedy, and what that does, it gets the onus off the back of the Secret Service. They say, "Well, you know, Kennedy had it coming. You know, he's reckless in his personal life. I guess he was reckless in the security, too," which is total bunk. And what really looks sinister for Floyd Boring, ironically, he's sitting there denying that that's true, but yet, under Warren Commission testimony, Clint Hill said, "Well, Floyd Boring, a couple of days before the assassination," I'm paraphrasing, "told us to not ride on the back of the car. Supposedly President Kennedy ordered him, and he's ordering us." So it's like, whoa, wait a minute. And when George, here's the other thing, too. It wasn't until years later, a lot of films and photos and documents came forward that we can compare and contrast things. And when you look at the Tampa motorcade, the many films and photos, I'm saying, wait a minute, there's agents on the back of the car doing basically the whole trip. What gives? So how could they have been ordered off if they're still on the back of the car? And that's when Russell Groover, the one Tampa motorcycle police officer, told me, "Oh, yeah, no, Vince, they were on the back of the car the entire time. The only time they were on the back of the car was at the end of the parade when everything was over and the public viewing was over, and we were going at very fast speeds between 60 and 70 miles an hour heading back to the airport, and Kennedy's trip was over. So they weren't on it, but here's what they did. On the single ranch-style homes, they had military police and regular police guarding, looking at the street and looking at those homes, so they were going to, you know, fast rate of speed. They didn't need agents on the back of the car. So just for your listeners, it wasn't always the case. Agents weren't always in the back of the car, but Kennedy had nothing to do with that, and that's the big myth that's thrown on him. So when we get to Dallas, no agents were in the back of the car. It was only until everything's over and done with, Clint Hill actually makes a late leap for the car. And interestingly, he's one of nine agents that drank the night before. Everyone was mad in 2012 in Cartagena, Colombia, when nine agents drank, but Obama wasn't even on site, and obviously he lived. Well, in 1963, nine agents, you know, drank the night before, and including
they partied pretty heavily, didn't they?
Yes, they did. In some accounts where they were totally bombed, my first book, Survivor's Guilt, is a chapter, and I had basically tying up some loose ends, and I talk about the drinking incident. And a couple, Fort Worth and national press said, "Oh, yeah, no, they were definitely heavy drinkers there." In fact, one agent in Italy pulled a gun on a bartender. He wanted to keep the bar open.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Vincent. Do you think the Secret Service was negligent or culpable?
Here's what I think. I think it was three agents that crossed the line that, sad to say, actually, I think that actually were involved in some way or shape and form in a conspiracy. I think the other 99% of the agents were squeaky clean and or just following orders. And I'm not afraid of naming names and producing evidence in my book, and I always do this in lectures and radio shows, and the three that I'm suspicious of are the aforementioned Floyd Boring. Turns out, again, this is only through years of research, he was the planner of the Texas trip from the Secret Service's point of view. It's a fact that 99.9% of people don't even realize. They always think of Governor Connally and, in the Democratic National Committee and working with Kennedy for the planning of the Texas trip, not realizing Floyd Boring had his hands over everything. That was number one. Emory Roberts was the commander of the Agents of the Fog Car. All the other Agents of the Fog Car, well, at Dallas Love Field, when the motorcade begins, I discovered this video in 1991. People probably saw it on YouTube, and it shows the beginning of the motorcade leaving. They got 40 minutes for Kennedy to live, and all of a sudden an agent stops and raises his hand three times, basically seeming disgust, like the universal what gives sign. It turns out that two agents were recalled at Love Field, and Emory Roberts is the one who stands up the fog car and waves them away. When the shooting began, wait to hear this, George, when the shooting began on Elm Street, Emory Roberts ordered the men not to move.
Not to move?
Yeah, he died in 1973. I spoke to Sam Kinney in 1992 and twice in 1994, and I ran that by him, and he told me about it because there was a line in Harrison Livingstone's book, High Treason, and he says that Emory Roberts ordered the men not to move. And I said, whoa, wait, there's no documentation on this. Where's Harry getting this? So I read this to Sam Kinney. He goes, exactly right. What do you mean? Exactly right. I'm involved in that, too. I said, what do you mean? Well, Emory ordered them because I had to move the car, and there was a certain way I had to swerve the car, and so Clint Rand jumped off, and he was afraid the other agents were going to get hurt. I ran this by a few other agents that were not from the Kennedy era, and they were appalled. They said that there's no logical reason a Secret Service agent would order the other men not to move. You're there to lunge forward. You're there to do your job. It doesn't matter if you're about your own personal safety. So Emory Roberts is ordering them not to move. He already recalled two agents at Love Field in a postscript about Emory Roberts, in the interest of time, all heavily documented. He became, get this now, the press secretary for Lyndon Johnson when Johnson became president. He took over for Dave Powers, literally sat in Dave Powers' desk because the press was wondering, wait, why is George Reedy sharing duties with a Secret Service agent who's still on active duty? And he became Emory Roberts became very chummy with LBJ, which is grist for the mill. And then the third agent that I'm suspicious of is Bill Greer, not for shooting Kennedy, but for letting the shots.
Slower?
Yeah, basically, for a whole bunch of things. Not only his actions and inactions on Elm Street to let the success of the assassination happen, and his son's cryptic comics, but Greer was one of only two Secret Service agents who was with the body from Parkland through and including Bethesda. He had President Kennedy's clothing, and he withheld him from the autopsy doctors. On the one hand, he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He says the right rear of Kennedy's head's gone. He doesn't think the single bullet theory is plausible. And yet, this lowly Secret Service agent is with Kennedy's body. And for people that believe in David Lipton, Doug Horne, and some other theories about body alteration and or body tampering or something shenanigans with the wounds, well, Bill Greer is one of your number one suspects because he's with the body the entire time. And he was on Air Force One near the casket. Use your imagination. But we can get into even more, George, about the nuts and bolts of what should have happened in Dallas.
All right, let's do that when we come back, Vince. Plus, I want to ask you, of course, why did they permit him to be in an uncovered car? That's ludicrous all by itself. Vincent Palomero with us, his latest book, The Not-So-Secret Service. And, of course, we will take your phone calls as well when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Vincent Palomara, as we talk about his work, of course, the latest, the Not-So-Secret Secret Service. We'll have another guest for you next hour, and we're going to take calls when we come back in a moment about the Secret Service and its role in the Kennedy assassination. Negligence, culpability, well, you've heard what Vincent's been saying. More to come in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're back with Vincent Palomara. We are going to take your calls as well in our final half hour with him. We'll still have a fourth guest for you with a different thoughts and theory on what happened. But Vincent, how in God's name could they let the president, with two possible assassination attempts in Tampa and Chicago, where they canceled those events, how could they let him go to Dallas in a car that was not covered?
Exactly, George. A lot of this information didn't come out till years later. It's common sense, but keep in mind, back in the 60s. It was before Woodward and Bernstein. It was before the congressional investigation, before authors and researchers and the advent of time. You know, in addition to, you know, the rooftops not being guarded, we find out, you know, years later they normally were guarded. In addition to the agents not being on the car, and normally they were, and it certainly had nothing to do with Kennedy. They blamed it on Kennedy after the fact, which is very suspicious. And like I said, yet in interviews and correspondence, the agents are adamantly denying Kennedy had anything to do with it. We also have a situation where the motorcycles normally covered the car, flanked the car on all sides in good number. And you can see it on the prior Texas stops. You can see it in Florida, many other trips, Berlin, Ireland, Chicago, Nashville, you name it. Yet he gets to Dallas, okay, after San Antonio, Houston, and Fort Worth, and supposedly the story is that, oh, Kennedy doesn't want all these motorcycles around him. He can't have conversation in the limo. So we're going to restrict it to four motorcycles, and then that insult to injury. They had the motorcycles riding behind the rear wheels, which made them totally useless for any kind of cover. And, you know, obviously professional IME or witnesses were eliminated from around the car. So it's very suspicious they were eliminated, just like the agents being on or near the rear of the car. And, you know, that day, in front of many millions of listeners and viewers, even some of the ABC newsmen like Rob Gardner and Bill Lord and other ones were saying, normally agents run or jog beside the car. We don't see any of these pictures. Also, the motorcycles normally are in good number. And that's very suspicious. They blamed it on Kennedy, and Kennedy had nothing to do with that either. In fact, the House Select Committee said it was uniquely insecure. The bubble top, and this is going to really interesting for listeners. Probably most people think that's rare. The bubble top was used anyway. Well, it turned out through research, again, this took years to do this, dredging photo archives, newspapers, whatnot, found out that Kennedy used the bubble top in at least one-third of all his motorcades, and usually in very good weather. And that was an option that was not explored there. Now, Sam Kinney, the driver of the FOV car, adamantly took responsibility for the bubble top's removal. He said, that's my responsibility. Kennedy had nothing to do with that. Kennedy O'Donnell had nothing to do with it. It was my decision. It's one thing I regret all these years, but it was my decision to not have the top. Well, a lot of times the top was on the car in partial form. They had the front and rear pieces on, and they'd leave the middle piece open to get some air and for him to stand intermittently, albeit at, you know, relatively fast speeds. That option was not explored there. Normally, there was a flatbed truck of still in motion photographers who were riding in front of the caravan. That happened on the prior stops in Florida, countless other stops. Yet he gets to Love Field, and Dallas Morning News reporter Tom Dillard and others says, that was canceled at the last minute. We rode in Chevrolet convertibles way in the back of the motorcade, put us literally out of the picture. We wouldn't need Abraham Zapruder, Orville Nixon, all these amateurs. We would have professional Ioneer witnesses. Some of us even had a live television feed, black and white video, but still, in front of the limousine. In fact, there's a video on there. Somebody's trying to debunk some of the Secret Service research I've done and others and said that, oh, look at this video from San Diego. Kennedy's a sitting duck. Meantime, there's two flatbed trucks in front of the limousine. There's Marines, a whole gaggle of Marines on both sides of the street, line street. There's motorcycles around the car. The special agent in charge on the trip. He's going at a good rate of speed. But see, that's what I mean. It's just all about he was left a sitting duck, and a lot of this was blamed on Kennedy. I just brought that up. Yeah, normally some branch of the military and or the police line the street in good numbers and face the crowd. He gets to Dallas. There's no military line of street. There's only a handful of police, and they're watching the motorcade. They're totally useless for security. And oftentimes, the police were in good number in the crowds themselves. So you had that situation.
Let's take some calls here for you, Vincent. Let's start by going to Alan in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Okay.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. I got some information for you.
All right. Sure. Pass it on.
This is firsthand information, I might say. The limousine, immediately after the assassination, the limousine was shipped to the world headquarters of Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, where my father and two other gentlemen, they were auto mechanics, replaced the front windshield because it had a bullet hole in it from the front.
Wow, yes.
The car was immediately sent back to D.C. the next morning. Now, my dad found a button off of Kennedy's coat, and my father passed away 5 months ago. We never publicized any of this.
Do you still have the button, Alan?
I still have the button.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Now, George Bush, Lyndon Johnson, and a handful of others were in Dallas that day. And they were patting each other on the back after the assassination.
Now, how do you know that?
I was stationed.
Well, Johnson, we all know, is the vice president. He was there, but yeah.
But, I mean, how do you know they were patting him on the back, Alan?
I was stationed in military in Texas, in San Antonio, and it's common knowledge what went on that day. Also common knowledge about Roswell. I knew in 72 that them saucers crashed and there was dead aliens. I knew that in 1972.
Well, there's no question. You're right about my dad worked at Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, as you well know, Alan. And there's no question that the limousine was shipped to Dearborn and they repaired it quickly. And that was a crime scene piece of evidence, Vincent. Why do you repair something like that?
Exactly. It's like it would be tantamount to, when Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater, let's take this chair and let's reupholster it for the next president to sit in. It's ridiculous. And they use that till some reports say 1977, some reports say 1978. Lyndon Johnson smiling in the renovated limousine. Nixon's on record saying it was his favorite limo, and he used it for his, I think, his first inaugural, yes. And, there's Kennedy agents walking beside the renovated car, and there's Pat Nixon and Richard Nixon smiling. Gerald Ford used it. It's obscene. And yet there's also some reports of Joe Palella. He was JFK agent who recently passed away. He came out and also admitted there was a bullet hole in the windshield, and a few other agents also did the same thing. One dating back to right when it happened, there's a report from Charles Taylor saying there was a bullet hole in the windshield. You won't read this in the Warren report, so there you go. So how could Oswald have fired, supposedly three bullets, and you talk about this, how fast it would happen and whatnot. But then there's another bullet hole. Uh-oh, it's in the windshield. How did that happen? So there you go. Yeah.
Let's go to Paul, first-time caller, Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, go ahead, sir.
Morning, guys. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you, Paul.
Yep, happy Thanksgiving. Well, I don't know if this is confirmed information or not. Your guests might know about it. When I was in the military, I worked with a guy. His father was in the Secret Service. Okay. And he had heard after the incident in Dallas, he wasn't there, that the guy that was on the back left of the vehicle, his firearm accidentally went off when the shooting started. And his firearm was aimed at the back of JFK's head and neck.
All right. What do you say about that, Vincent?
Yeah, that's Howard Donahue, the late Howard Donahue, and Bonar Mettinger came out with a book called Mortal Error in 1992. It was picked up by Colin McLaren, an Australian detective for the Reels TV network called The Smoking Gun. And basically it's saying that George Hickey, Secret Service agent in the FOB car, raised the AR-15 and accidentally shot President Kennedy when Oswald was also firing. So that's why everybody said, oh, there's multiple shots. It was all innocent. Oswald acted alone. It was George Hickey accidentally. It was friendly fire. Well, the good news is that Howard Donahue's ballistic work shows that Oswald couldn't have fired the fatal shot. The bad news for Howard Donahue and other people that believe that is there's a film by, it's no relation to the actor of the same name, Charles Bronson. He was there in
Okay.
taking a film. It conclusively proves that George Hickey didn't raise the AR-15 at the moment of truth, didn't fire the weapon. And obviously there's no witnesses there at the time that said as much. But they did smell gunpowder, so everyone was like, oh, that could mean that George Hickey. No. They smelled it on the knoll as well. So how could that quick gunpowder smell on the street, so it couldn't have been Oswald? Well, again, forget the innocent Hickey theory. It was also on the knoll. But that film by an amateur, Charles Bronson, it shows that Hickey didn't fire the weapon. But, yeah, it was very popular in the 5 years ago. The Reels Network had that documentary. Yeah.
Let's go to Wayne in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Wayne, good morning.
Hey, thank you, George. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
You too, Wayne.
Oh, same to you.
Yes, your guests, thank you for your knowledge. And I'd just like to ask you two quick questions.
Sure.
Can you elaborate a little bit on what exactly happened to Abraham Bolden? And here's another question.
Sure.
I think it was like 40th anniversary, and I saw these two Secret Service agents on TV. I think it was like a mini documentary. They were standing in front of a garage with a car, with a little kid, still saying that Oswald was the lone shooter. My jaw just dropped to the floor because They said they were there at the assassination, two Secret Service agents.
Mm-hmm.
I jumped to the floor because I said, how could they think we're that stupid after 40 years they would still be saying the same thing?
Hey, I know exactly what you're talking about. I could just address them real briefly for you. Yeah,
sure.
Abraham Bolden is actually, I call him a dear friend of mine. Since the early 90s, Abraham Bolden was the first African-American agent to serve on the White House detail by President Kennedy's appointment. It's himself. He served on a 30-day trial run, and you might say, 30 days? How come it only lasts 30 days? He lasted 30 days because the oppressive racism he faced from Mississippi agents like Harvey Henderson, who called him the N-word and other things, and his fellow Caucasian agents didn't get along with him because they didn't want a black agent there, to put it mildly. Abraham Bolden came out with a book called Echo and Dealey Plaza in 2008.
Is he still alive?
Yes, very much so. Great guy. He's in his early 80s, doing fantastic. He's just a terrific guy all the way around. He adamantly believes there was a conspiracy. More to the point, he believes there was a conspiracy in Chicago a few weeks before that was foiled, and then it came to fruition in Dallas. He warned everybody about Secret Service laxity, how there was agents of Secret Service who had held Kennedy in contempt for his, you know, sexual trysts and also his view on civil rights. And, you know, that could be the motive for some of these agents to stand down just for a few seconds to let it happen, to get let a Texan in the White House and have a different view on Vietnam, Cuba, Russia, et cetera, et cetera. On the other gentleman's point about the agents he's talking about, yeah, that's a documentary called The Kennedy Detail of the book of the same name by a very obscure agent named Gerald Blaine, who only served 5 years in the agency, and he quit. He's like a buck private. Yet the brass of the Secret Service, men far more experience in years, and they were way ahead of him, told me in no uncertain terms that President Kennedy never ordered the agents off the car, had nothing to do with that, never interfered with their actions. And also, like I said before, 12 agents adamantly believed there was a conspiracy. Gerald Blaine came out with this book a few years ago to try to squelch everything. Said, oh, Oswald had to load, and Kennedy ordered us off the car. You might say, well, Vince, what do you have to say about that? What I have to say about that is Gerald Blaine told me years before his book came out on more than one occasion joining the chorus, oh, President Kennedy was a very nice man, never interfered with actions at all. But when he saw dollar signs, and more importantly, when he saw my work on the Internet before my book was published, first book, that's when he panicked and he came out. And he actually named me on C-SPAN a couple times. So this isn't
really
grandeur. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Clint Hill and Gerald Blaine were there with the CEO of C-SPAN a couple times. Basically mocking me, showing a YouTube video. This is a gentleman named Vince Palmer. Do you know him? Oh, I'm aware of him. Sure, I know him. And they're basically trying to say, oh, this is hogwash. This kid wasn't even born when the assassination happened, and blah, blah, blah. Meantime, these guys are telling me things against official history, but then, you know, they had books to write, and they had worried about their pensions and reputations, and there you have it. But they told me something, things diametrically opposed to what they're saying in their book now. And if anybody turns to page 359 to 360 of the Kennedy Detail, you'll see he mocks me and calls me a Secret Service expert, in quotes, doesn't name me because he's afraid of libel or whatnot. Well, that's little old me. And there's no truth to what he's saying. The agents I spoke to knew they were being recorded. They had no problem with that. And they told me what they told me, and he has a problem with it. Well, oh, well, Gerald Blaine, you're out there. You told me the same thing. You told me President Kennedy didn't order you up the car, but yeah, he's saying something different now because he realizes, George, that the onus is back on the Secret Service. Wait a minute.
Right.
Oswald act alone or not, you mean to tell me President Kennedy could have been saved? That's why they're doing what they're doing with their little books and tours and DVDs and everything else. So,
what would you say, Vincent, would be the most compelling fact that would convince everybody that the Secret Service was negligent?
Oh, well, without question, the fact that I make the analogy, it would be like if, you know, President, it's Trump now, but President Obama, he's going to Mississippi, and we're supposed to believe that nobody in Mississippi wished ill will on Obama, and yet he goes there, he's warned not to go, and there's hardly any security for him, and the man, unfortunately, is assassinated. We're supposed to believe, oh, there's nothing to this. A man in a building shot a man in a car. It's time to get a life and move on, and yet you realize, wait a minute, the agents at the time are blaming President Kennedy for these inactions. You look at the films and photos of previous trips like I did, took years to do, you realize, wait a minute, many times agents were on or near the car. Many times the bubble top was used. Many times the motorcycles flanked the car in good numbers. What was this flatbed truck? We wouldn't need amateurs filming. There was all these still motion photographers feet away filming them. Oh, my God, there was multi-story building, rooftops guarded. There was, you know,
off. But what was it? Was it stupidity?
No. No, unfortunately, what it was, point blank, there's no other way to sugarcoat it. There's those three agents I named, Floyd Boring, Emory Roberts, and Bill Greer. They were the keystones to everything happened. Bill Greer driving a limousine slows the car down, lets it all happen. Emory Roberts orders the men not to move. And Floyd Boring is the planner of the Texas trip. He's going around a couple days before the assassination. It's there in the Warren Commission report and in the testimony, telling the agents, don't ride in the back of the car. President Kennedy doesn't want you there. And yet Floyd Boring's telling me the total opposite. Imagine my shock, George, in the early 90s. The phone was dropped. He's talking, oh, no. And I have him on tape, too, so you can't say, oh, Vince, you're mistaken. Oh, no. President Kennedy was a very nice man. That's not true. He never wore us off the car, never interfered with our actions at all. Well, because of little old me, his JFK Library oral history from 1976 resurfaced in 1999. I got it out because they had a bad problem with the transcript because the tape went bad. When they worked, they're transcribers. And right there, in 1976, the President Kennedy and his staff were very cooperative with the Secret Service. Nothing about ordering them off the car or anything. In the interest of time, Drew, I have to get this in.
Yeah, I've got 20 seconds left. Go.
Oh, okay. Tom Shipman, Kennedy's driver, he died on October 14, 1963, of a heart attack at Camp David. And that gave Bill Greer his opportunity to drive Kennedy to his death in Dallas. Shipman, that came out only in the late 90s because of my research. Shipman died at Camp David of an alleged heart attack, a fit agent, and that's why Bill Greer was able to drive Kennedy to his death.
It's horrible fate, to be sure. Vincent, thank you so much. Vincent's books are available on his website, which are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, a roundabout way of covering it all next.